Welcome to the Digital Leaders Podcast. Today's guest is Professor Sue Black, OBE. She's Professor of Computing Science and Technology at Durham University, a digital skills expert, social entrepreneur, consultant, and international keynote speaker. She has over 20 years technology and digital skills teaching experience, along with successful social media campaigning and women and leadership expertise. Hello, Sue, and great to have you on the Digital Leaders Podcast.
Hi, Robin. Thanks very much for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What do you do, Sue?
Well, so many things. But I guess my main job now is Professor of Computer Science and Technology Evangelist at Durham University. So based up there now, and I live in London and Durham at the same time. Spend half a week in each, really. And my role at Durham is, well, lots of things, all the usual kind of professory things like research and teaching. But also we've got an amazing project called Tech Up Women, which is an Institute of Coding funded project taking 100 women through a retraining program. So retraining them from not being in tech to being in a tech career. So that takes up quite a bit of my time. Really focusing on kind of like building the profile of Durham in terms of a great destination for computer science, but also particularly for women in tech, looking at increasing our number of female undergraduate students, because we've got, I think, about 17% at the moment, which in fact is pretty standard across the university sector in the UK. But we really want to try and get that up to 50% over the next few years. Doing loads of different things really around sort of public engagement of computer science, technology, and trying to bang the drum, which I've been doing for years, around women in tech, more diversity in technology.
So you're a professor. You weren't always an academic, or is being an academic kind of hard-baked into the family? What are your early influences?
Well, so I actually left school at 16. So no, definitely. I guess going to university was my dream to actually get a degree. But at 16, leaving home, I'd had not such a great time at home. My mum had died when I was 12. Then my dad remarried quite quickly and possibly to the wrong person, just a personal opinion. Then my life kind of went from living in a functional family to living in a dysfunctional family. I wanted to get out as soon as I could, so I left home at 16. I tried to stay on at school, but it was just impossible. So I left school kind of during the first year of my A-levels. And after about a year, I was living out in Essex. After about a year, moved to London. I'd always wanted to live in London. Worked in various roles and got married at 20. Had my daughter, Emma, when I was 21. And then I thought to myself, well, I'll have another baby and then I'll go back to work. And that other baby turned out to be twin boys. So had twin boys when I was 23. And unfortunately, what happened after that was that my marriage broke down. I ended up in a women's refuge with my three children for 6 months. And then at the age of, I think, 25, was starting life again, really, on the other side of London from where we've been living, living in a council flat in Brixton. I got my daughter then, who was just four, into school, into reception, got the boys into playgroup. And then I thought, well, I need to get a job and earn some money. But what I realized was, because I'd left school at 16 with five O-levels, I didn't have many qualifications. So actually, if I got a job, I was probably going to be on minimum wage. And on minimum wage, I wouldn't even really be able to pay for childcare for three children, let alone support the family. So I realized that I couldn't actually go back to work. So then my thoughts went back to education. You know, I hadn't really wanted to leave school when I was 16. So I looked around for courses that I could do, found like a fast track maths course at Southwark College, did that for a year, and that enabled me to go to apply and go to university. So I went to London South Bank Uni, did a degree in computing. I was very excited about technology. I loved maths, like always. It was always my favourite subject at school. So I thought about doing a maths degree, but I was excited about technology. And also, I always had at the back of my mind that I needed to earn money. And I thought I'd probably earn more money if I did a degree in computing. So did a degree, then stayed on, did a PhD in software engineering. During my PhD, I became an academic. So I applied for a position as a lecturer at South Bank. I got that and started teaching. taught for several years there. And anytime I could apply for a promotion, I did. So I went from lecturer to senior lecturer to principal lecturer, and then applied for a job at the University of Westminster as head of department and got that. So I think around 2006, I moved to University of Westminster as head of department there, stayed there for 4 years. How long do you want me to keep going, Robin?
I'm sure our listener, like myself, is just fascinated. Lapping up this extraordinary journey. I mean, clearly huge motivation on your part to put, you know, to sort of move forward. And presumably, I mean, when did you do your computer science degree? Were you the only woman on the course? I mean, sort of.
No, there were actually, I think the class was, 83, and I think 8 of us were women, so about 10% at the time. But the thing is, during my degree, I honestly didn't notice it at all. You know, I was just very happy to be in education. I had loads of friends. I was, 26 by then, and loads of my class were like 18-year-old guys, and I was kind of like Auntie Sue in the class. So I just had lots of friends and had a great time. So I didn't really think about the gender thing at all, I don't think, during my degree. And in fact, not really until I was doing my PhD. And my PhD supervisor said, you know, like when you go to conferences, because of course, as a PhD student, as an academic, you go to research conferences. When you go to conferences, you've got to network. And for me, that was kind of the worst thing that you could ask me to do. I was actually quite shy. I've completely got over that now. But when I was younger, I really was still very shy. And so for me to go up and talk to people I didn't know at conferences was a very scary thing. And but I kind of, because my supervisor had told me I needed to do it, I said, okay, I've got to do it. So the first conference I went to, there was a guy who gave a great talk. He seemed very down to earth, kind of on stage. So I chatted to him in the break about my research, had a great chat with him. But then for the rest of the conference, every time I turned around, he was staring at me. And of course, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but I got totally freaked out by it. I just didn't know. I didn't know why he was staring at me. All I could think was, I said something that upset him, and that's why he was staring at me. So that wasn't so great as my first kind of experience. I'm feeling very, very underconfident in that kind of situation. And I had a few other experiences going to academic computer science conferences and trying to chat to people that just really didn't work out very well. So then as part of the British Computer Society Central London branch, I was on the committee. I got invited to a Women in Science conference in Brussels in 1998. I remember walking into that conference thinking, oh no, like, you know, what have I done? Another conference, I've got to talk to people, I'm not very good at it. I walked into the conference, you know, got my badge from registration, went to get a cup of tea. And somehow for the whole 2 days of that conference, I didn't once worry about that out at all, because it just seemed like everyone was talking to everyone like all the time. It was just very, very relaxed and easy. And it really kind of changed my life in a way, in that it showed me that if you're in the majority, life is just easier. You know, there just weren't any barriers there at all to talking to people, and no one kind of misconstruing anything. It was amazing. And so I came back from there, from that conference, thinking I've got to do something so that I can kind of create this in the UK, like some kind of network, and decided then to set up an online network for women in computing within the BCS, and called it BCS Women, and basically set up an online network so that we could all connect to each other as women to chat about technology online. So even though we didn't meet in person, you know, we could meet online and we could chat to each other and ask questions about particular things to do with technology. And that was then the UK's first online network for women in tech. So that was back in 98, and BCS Women's still going strong now, which is great. And that kind of led me up to, I think in 2003, because I was chair of that group, I got invited up to Bletchley Park for the first time. And on the way there, I didn't really know much about it. I think I knew that science, I think what was in my head was that 50 code breakers worked there, kind of all old guys, and for some reason wearing tweed jackets and smoking pipes and doing the Times crossword. I don't know where I got that image from. And then maybe a bit of code breaking on the side. So that was my kind of image of Bletchley Park. I knew it was code breaking during the Second World War, but that's about it. I didn't know anything else at all. Of course, some of that was wrong. And so I went to the meeting there and then went for a walk around afterwards. And it's a, you know, 26-acre site, so it's quite a lot to look at there. And bumped into these guys that were rebuilding Turing's Bomb Machine. Had a great chat with them. They were telling me all about Turing and industrialization of the code-breaking process, which I found fascinating. And then they asked me why I was there. So I said, oh, I'm here representing this group of women in computing. And they said, well, did you know that more than half the people that worked at Bletchley Park were women? And I was like, no, I just had no clue about that at all. So I said, how many people worked here? And they said more than 10,000. So I was completely blown away by that because I really did think it was 50 old blokes. And so the fact that 10,000 people worked there and about 8,000, I think it was, women, I was just fascinated by that. And I thought, I've got to do something to raise the profile of those women. So I went away, raised some funding to run an oral history project. And we recorded the memories of 15 of the women, including Mavis Beatty, one of the code breakers who worked there. And then at the launch of that project in 2008, Simon Grealish, who was the director of Bletchley Park at the time, gave a talk, and he said that he was really worried that Bletchley Park might have to close. They were really struggling with funding. He said they were teetering on a financial knife edge. And he said, and if we close, we'll never be able to open again. So I thought, oh, that's terrible, you know, and it was kind of in the back of my mind that I should do something about it. And then a few weeks after that, I was invited up to a reception at Bletchley Park. And for the first time, I did kind of a full tour of the site with one of the people that had worked there. So with one of the amazing veterans. And he told us all about the incredible code-breaking achievements in each of the huts as we kind of went round. And I got more of a sense of the history and the contribution of everything that had happened there. And at the end of his talk, we were kind of standing looking at Hut 6, which at that time had a blue tarpaulin over the end and looked like it was about to fall down. And he said, and the work that was done here was said to have shortened World War II by 2 years. And at that time, 11 million people a year were dying. So I just thought to myself, so this place saved the lives of 22 million people and it might have to close. That's terrible. I've got to do something about it. So, yep. So at that time, I was head of department at the University of Westminster. So I emailed all of the heads and profs of computing in the country, said, we've got to save Bletchley Park. Sent them a photo that I'd taken of Hut 6 with a blue tarpaulin. And over the next kind of week or two, with all the heads and professors' support, managed to get onto BBC News on the Today programme, was interviewed by Rory Cefflin-Jones. And we wrote a letter, which was then in the Times newspaper. So had amazing reaction from that, with hundreds of people emailing me, getting in touch, that I passed on to Bletchley Park. And then, but then after that, it all kind of quietened down and nothing had really happened. So there'd been lots of interest, but Bletchley Park didn't have any more money. So I wasn't quite sure what to do. And I was kind of casting around for some time to thinking, you know, how am I going to raise awareness of Bletchley Park's situation? And it wasn't really till the end of 2008 when I started using Twitter in earnest and realized quite quickly that just by typing Bletchley Park in the search box in Twitter, I could reach people that are already tweeting or talking about Bletchley Park and have a chat with them online, sometimes in real time, and get them involved in what then kind of turned into a campaign to save Bletchley Park. And so, yeah, that was the end of 2008. I set up a blog because I wanted to kind of showcase what we were doing and let people know the situation as we were going through the campaign. Various people got in touch with me through Twitter, which was amazing. Took them up to Bletchley Park, went to and kind of brought people along to talks by code breakers like Captain Jerry Roberts, and we're just trying to kind of raise interest in general. Then one day in February 2009, I saw a tweet from Stephen Fry. He tweeted a selfie of himself and some friends who were stuck in a lift in Centre Point in London. I saw that tweet and I just thought, Stephen Fry, he must be interested in Bletchley Park. I know he likes history. I know he likes technology. Why don't I try and, message him and see if he'll help? And when I checked my Twitter profile, luckily he was following me on Twitter. And so I was able to send him several direct messages saying, you know, if you get involved, I think it'll make a massive difference in the campaign. We have to save Bletchley Park. And then the next morning he tweeted a link to my blog. And I was getting about 50 hits a day at that time, I think, and one tweet from Stephen Fry, and I got 8,000 hits that day and was actually the most retweeted person in the world on Twitter. So that's in early 2009. So it made an incredible impact really, really quickly.
It's so great to listen to this to your kind of backstory. And I know we haven't got to the present day yet, but I'll jump in and draw breath. So well, that's what a dream to get. To get one tweet from a sort of superstar on Twitter,
I think on Twitter in the UK at that time, I think he had the most followers of everybody.
Yes, he's always been kind of famous.
Yeah,
in that space, I know Apple used to sort of make sure he got the latest.
That's right. Yeah. So that was later on. Yeah.
Yeah, he was very proud of that.
Yeah.
So that presumably started to get the money rolling in, or kind of. Really transformed.
Well, yeah, not straight away, really. So, you know, we were still doing various things. The campaign was 3 years in the end. So, and that was starting July 2008. And I think it was about April 2011 when we actually knew that everything was going to be okay. So that's reasonably early on in the campaign. But what it did was helped us to get more people engaged through Twitter, really. And that kind of made a sort of step change in the amount of people that I had following me, that Bletchley Park had following them, and people that kind of on Twitter mainly that knew about the campaign and were trying to do something about it.
Was the campaign fundamentally raising capital for building works?
Yeah, the main thing I was doing was really trying to raise awareness and find people to come in and support in any way that they could. So, you know, like various people, like one guy ran a comedy night to raise funds. Someone else walked to Everest Base Camp to raise funds. So people did all different sorts of things to try and raise awareness and money. My specific goal was not to raise the funding myself, but to find the people to bring in and introduce to Bletchley Park. And then Bletchley Park would kind of pitch them, basically. So I kind of like found people or organizations, and then Bletchley Park did that kind of, you know, had those kind of conversations. And so later on in the campaign, when Alan Turing's papers were up for auction at Christie's, so I was a kind of, you know, talking to Christie's and, there was a guy called Gareth Harfacree set up a Just Giving to try and raise funds for Bletchley Park to buy the Turing papers. And I think with about a week to go, I think he had about £20,000 raised, but the price they were up for was £300,000 to £500,000. So, you know, like £20,000 is a hell of a lot of money, but it's nowhere near £300,000. So I was kind of looking at that thinking, how can I help him? How can I help raise that money for Bletchley Park? And actually I was at a talk at Nesta in London, which was part of Silicon Valley Comes to the UK. So I think it was November 2010. And Megan Smith, who was then a VP at Google and went on to be CTO of the United States with President Obama, but we didn't know that then. So she was talking on a panel, and I just saw her talking. She seemed really cool. I thought she might be interested in Bletchley Park, and she worked for Google. I just thought to myself, Google, they've got a lot of money. And, you know, like they're a tech company, surely they'll be interested. So I had a chat with her at the end of her talk and told her all about Turing, Turing papers, all about Bletchley Park. And I mean, it was basically through connection with Google, who then gave Bletchley Park towards the Turing papers, gave $100,000, which they raised really quickly. So that was incredible. And eventually enabled Bletchley Park to buy the Turing papers. But also I kind of like continued connecting Google into Bletchley Park after that as well, and kind of trying to finesse the relationship. So, because what I really wanted was Google to give loads of money to Bletchley Park. So just kind of tried to keep that going. And eventually they did give some funds to Bletchley Park. And also I was part of a team at Google that organized a garden party, like a tea party at Bletchley Park, to say thank you to everyone that had been involved in the campaigning over the 3 years. So that was an amazing day at Bletchley Park. My job was more kind of like trying to bring people into Bletchley Park who Bletchley Park could then talk to tell them the situation and ask for their help.
So I should know the answer to this question. I assume Bletchley Park is saved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 2011. Yeah, so in 2011, Bletchley Park, they'd applied for Heritage Lottery funding before I started the campaign and not got it. And then they applied again And I guess they must have got the kind of go-ahead from the lottery fund in 2011, because that's when the director told me that Bletchley Park was saved and I didn't have to worry about it anymore. And they got 4.1 million from Heritage Lottery with, I think, 1.6 million match funding or something. So, and that's how they were able to renovate all the huts, which have now been renovated.
And you wrote a book about it.
I did, yes. So after the campaign, so many people said, well, what did you actually do? And also lots of people that I then knew from Twitter kind of knew bits and pieces of what we'd done over the 3 years, but not all of it. So just so many people wanted to know what we'd done in terms of the kind of campaign, but also how we'd use social media, because it's an early instance of social media being used for good and being used to save a heritage site. So I thought, actually, you know, I still wanted to promote Bletchley Park and get people going there. So I thought, if I write a book about it, it kind of ticks loads of boxes, I suppose, for me, really, in that it promotes social media, because I believe without Twitter, Bletchley Park would not have been saved. So it promotes social media. And you know, back then, still now, lots of people think social media is an evil thing, but it's not. It's just, you know, it's just a platform for people to engage through. So it's neither good or evil. And I really wanted to tell the story also kind of for everyone that got involved, because there were so many people involved in that campaign who did all different sorts of things through Twitter. And I kind of wanted to tell their stories as well. And then also tell the story of the history of Bletchley Park and what happened there, and highlight the women's contribution and all of that kind of stuff. So actually, I wrote the whole story of what we did using social media. And my friend Steve Colgan, who's one of the QI elves, wrote all the kind of more historical chapter about the women that worked there, you know, who was Alan Turing, how's the Enigma machine work, all that sort of thing.
I guess the question is, what campaign, or what are you working on now? What has replaced Bletchley Park. Passion?
Yeah. So after I left the University of Westminster, I set up a social enterprise, Tech Mums. You know, I still absolutely love technology, and I really see how technology and education have just massively changed my life. And through changing my life, it's changed my children's lives as well. You know, and kind of like the ripple effect of that will kind of go down the generations. You know, if I just think about the difference, if I hadn't gone back into education, I might still be on benefits now, you know, years later, who knows what would have happened, and just unable to do so many of the things that I've managed to do. I love technology, and I want everyone to kind of reap the benefits of the opportunities that technology provides us. And I was after leaving the University of Westminster, I was trying to work out, while I was writing the Bletchley Park book at the same time, kind of what can I do to help everyone realize the benefits of technology? And I started thinking, well, I need to, we need to teach kids tech. And at the time, there was no coding in schools or anything. It's about 8 years ago. So I thought, well, why don't we try teaching kids coding and app design? So organized some workshops and ran those with seven-year-old kids. And I think partly what was in my mind was, at that time, the education minister, Michael Gove, was saying that computing is too difficult for anyone under 14. And I just thought, that's a load of rubbish. And I'm sure that's not true. So I think that was partly my mind. I wanted to prove that seven-year-olds could design apps, or could, you know, write basic code or understand coding. So we ran those workshops. And what we did was, the kids would be in the workshops all day. Then we get the parents in at the end of the day. And what I noticed when I was encouraging the parents to have a go at what the kids had been doing during the day, at the end of the day, in general, so not everyone, but in general, the dads would just kind of like step in to have a look and, you know, like say, you know, what do you want me to do? But quite a few of the mums looked extremely apprehensive and didn't really want to do that. It was quite obvious. And that just kind of sparked a thought in my head, you know, like, why don't I put together a program to teach mums technology, so that it shows them what opportunities are out there for them in terms of just understanding different things online, but then helping their kids to stay safe, helping their family to stay safe online, but also showing them how to set up their own business online, you know, just what opportunities are out there. So why don't I put together a program to teach mums tech? And of course, for every mum that we get, each mum has got at least one child. So for every person that we target, we get at least two people on board and kind of more positive about technology. So I put together a program and started teaching that at school in Tower Hamlets about 7 years ago now. And we had great success straight away, really, with the mums going through the program. They just looked so obviously more confident by the end of the program than they did at the beginning. And at that time, it was only a 10-hour program, 2 hours a week for 5 weeks, teaching stuff like app design, web design, how to stay safe online, how to use social media, a bit of coding, and some sort of basic IT skills, I guess. And yeah, the mum's confidence just completely rocketed. We had Brunel University run a research, set up a research framework to measure the mum's attitudes towards technology, but also towards themselves. And their attitude towards technology improved, but their attitude towards themselves was just so massively different. So everyone just became so much more confident from learning those tech skills. So then we realized that it's not just about the technology. If we can build confidence in the mums as well, then that's incredible, because that, again, not only affects them, but affects their kids too in a positive way. And so we've run Tech Mums for 7 years now around the country in different places. It's still going strong. We're looking at going across the UK by the end of this year, and we're also kind of talking to other countries about going international.
I love the idea that you know, if you teach a mum, she can help a child. I also love the idea of millions of children cursing you as they have to share the laptop with their mum. But you know, unintended consequences of
that. I'm not apologising.
So yes, so look, tell me, I'm really keen to give you a chance to talk about what you're focused on now. So tell us about Tech Up Women.
Yeah, so Tech Up Women is a project that I guess was my idea about 15 months ago, and amazingly has just finished its first sort of run through. So when I started at Durham University, which was November 2018, I'd become aware, sort of previous to that, of the Institute of Coding, which is like central government funded body, which was set up a couple of years ago. And I was aware of it, and I was aware that there was going to be a call, or there was a call for proposals for programs which were teaching people at kind of university level tech kind of like tech knowledge, and they were basically looking for proposals to do something a bit different, I think, really. And I went to a town hall in Manchester where the Institute of Coding just explained everything about the program and listened to exactly what they were saying and kind of all the boxes that they wanted ticked, and got very excited because all the things that they kind of wanted was the sort of thing that I wanted as well. And I kind of felt like through my whole career, that's the first time that I've heard a kind of call for proposals for funding from anywhere where everything that they want is actually what I want to do. So I got very excited and put together a program. So I kind of had the idea throughout my career, loads of people have asked me, because I'm always talking about women in tech and sort of tech skills, digital skills. Throughout my career, I have people asking me from companies, tech companies, saying, you know, like, we want more techie women. Where do we find them? Because we advertise jobs and either, you know, like, no women apply, or not very women apply, or we get some women applying, but they don't get through to the hiring stage. So how can we recruit more women? So I've heard that over and over and over again. And then at the same time throughout my life, I've just met so many amazing women that want to work in tech but don't know where to start. So they might have a degree in a completely different subject, and like, they say, so should I do a coding course, or should I go and do a master's, or what should I do? You know, like, I'm excited about technology, I want to work in technology, but I don't know how to do that. So I've kind of seen these two groups for quite a long time, and it's been kind of in my mind at some point, I've got to try and do something about this. So this call for proposals was from the Institute of Coding was ideal, really, because it, you know, that's exactly what they were interested in, really. So what I did was work out, well, how do I join A to B? So how do we take these women and train them into jobs in technology? So we put together, so from Durham University, we brought in three other university partners and 17 industry partners, and put together a program which was taking the industry needs into account. So we asked the industry partners, what job roles do you want these women trained into? You know, like, what are your top three jobs that you want to employ technical women into? And so we asked all 17 companies, and the top four job roles were software developer, agile project manager, business analyst, and data scientist. So then with the other professor at Durham University, Alexandra Christia, we put together a program which would take people who will take women with degrees through a program. So with degrees in music or law or medicine, or any degree background, through a program which would take them into one of those job roles. So we put that program together, and We put out a call for women to apply. So we were particularly looking for women from underrepresented backgrounds. So really focused on BAME women, on women from work. So the whole lot of funding was for, that we focused on, was for the North, sorry, the North of England and the Midlands. So we were particularly targeting the North of England and the Midlands. And we really wanted to focus on BAME women, on parents, on carers, on women with disabilities and LGBTQ plus women, to really serve kind of like underrepresented women. And we put out a call for women to apply. They had to send in their CV, fill in an application form and do a 1-minute selfie video saying why they wanted to be on the program. And so we put out the call. We had 219 applications for 100 places. And we had, of our applicants that got through, we had more than 50% BAME, which I was very excited about, because kind of going back to my BCS women experience at that conference, I really wanted to try and make it majority BAME, because I think if you're in the UK, most of the time, that's not your experience. So we recruited the women, and the program started in July at Durham University. And basically the program is an online course to train the women through from basics of computer science through to those four job roles. And I know that from any online course that I've ever done, I don't think I've ever finished one of them. So I knew that we had to try and build in loads of stuff to try and keep the women on the course. So we really focused on getting them together. So we had four residential weekends, one in each of the partner universities, finishing in Nottingham last month. And so it's a 6-month online course, four residential weekends that everyone came to, where we had talks from inspiring speakers, we had tech workshops, all different sorts of things, really focused on building confidence with technology, getting everyone to kind of bond with each other, make friends with each other, get to know each other. And we also had a LinkedIn group that everyone could kind of get mentoring through. We also had Microsoft Teams areas where the women could all chat to each other, ask questions about specific topics to either us, to our team, or to each other. And every woman had an industry mentor as well, which they had an hour a week of their time, because I was just trying to build in lots of things around the whole program to keep everyone on the course. And we had, in fact, we had 96% retention, which I think is pretty much unheard of. And we had all of the women graduating in Nottingham last month at just an incredible, incredible day. And now they're all interviewing for jobs in industry.
Huge congratulations. So that's, have you got funding for more cohorts?
No, we don't. The main thing I'm focused on now, a lot of my time now, is trying to find more funding. So we had, I mean, it costs about $500,000 to run it. So, you know, but that's only, if I've got my maths right, that's only £5,000 per person going through the program. You know, for a company trying to recruit women into technical roles, you know, it costs more than £5,000 to recruit someone. So, you know, why not spend the money training someone up to come and work for you? You know, I think it's a no-brainer from my point of view. And so, yeah, I'm talking to lots of different companies and organizations. We chatted to Chris Skidmore, the Minister for Universities and Science at Durham a couple of weeks ago, about tech up women. We're basically talking to everybody, because we know that it works, right? Our women are now getting employed. Some women got jobs before they finished the program. Some instead kind of went on to do masters before they went into job roles. It's just been amazingly successful. Industry, I hear from industry all the time, they want more women, more technical women. Here's a way to get them, really.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
So this is the Digital Leaders Podcast, so we will touch briefly, because it's been great to hear so much about your background and some of the amazing projects you've been working on. Yeah. I mean, you are a digital leader. I'm going to ask you a slightly tricky question. Are there attributes that women have in leadership that make them better digital leaders than men?
Well, I would actually say See, I don't think it's like women versus men. What I think is we all bring something, and what you need is diversity. So it's not about women or men. It's about having a diverse group of people at the top, so in your leadership teams, so that you can bring as much experience from all different backgrounds as possible to make the best decisions. So in fact, you're probably expecting me to say yes, but I really think it's about kind of diversity of thought and bringing people together with different experience to be able to make those decisions. I think things go wrong when you've got groupthink, when you've got everyone thinking in roughly the same way because they've had the same background. So, you know, maybe because they're all male, they've all had the same background. You know, what you need is people coming at problems from all different angles, and you can't do that if everyone's got the same kind of background.
No, great answer. I wasn't sure what you were going to say. I think I'm really glad you said what you did because...
Okay, good.
That's
what I truly believe.
It comes up, it keeps on coming up on the podcast, really.
Right, okay.
The importance of diversity in teams. And I couldn't agree more. So look, we are running out of time and our listener is always keen for us to do our quick fire round.
Yes.
At the end. So which book would you recommend to our listener? And what?
Well, I have to say the best book that I've read recently, which I think is a game changer, is Invisible Women by Caroline Criado Perez. I don't know if you've read it, Robin, but it's just an incredible book, and I would recommend it to everybody, not just women, to everyone, because it's highly readable. I was going to read it anyway, you know, whether it was kind of easy to read or not, but it's very easy to read, very interesting, just incredible how, yeah, I mean, Invisible Women tells you, you know, kind of what it's all about, but it's about data. And the fact that women have just been kind of left out of, you know, like, for example, medical trials, most medical trials for drugs are all on men. That, you know, they, most of them don't even include any women at all, but then women are taking those drugs and sometimes that can go wrong. Just all different sorts of things. It's a real eye opener. It's just won the Financial Times Science Book of the Year. And I'm sure it'll go on to win many more prizes. It's a great book.
So I'm going to be hugely embarrassed to say that I've listened to at least two interviews with Caroline talking.
Yeah, yeah.
And I listened to her book in an abridged format.
Yeah.
And I'm extremely pleased to say that she was our keynote speaker at the Power and Responsibility Summit last October. And she was just amazing.
Yeah.
And that's a great conference too. We're going to be inviting you to come to the British Library in October, I think, to...
Okay, great.
About, you know, the issues around power, responsibility, data bias.
Yeah.
And the unintended consequences of tech. So
cool.
I hope that's going to be a great follow-up today. Who would you like to have lunch with, living or dead, and why?
Yeah, so I had a lot of thought about this question. Do you know what? The person I would really like to sit down and chat to is not Ada Lovelace, but Ada Lovelace's mum, because everyone talks about Ada Lovelace as Byron's daughter, but I think she didn't even meet Byron. You know, he wasn't involved in her upbringing at all, Lord Byron, but it was her mum that wanted her to study mathematics. And so I think we've got a lot to be grateful for to her mum. And I would really love to chat to her about why she made that decision.
And an extraordinary decision at that time.
I mean, absolutely. I only
discovered the Ada Lovelace Lord Byron link recently.
Okay.
So she must have had an incredible mum.
Yeah, completely.
Okay, last question of our podcast is, what one thing do you think would surprise our listener to find out about you? And given all you've told us so far, that's probably a tough question.
Yeah, well, so this is very hard for me to answer because I'm always talking about everything to do with my life, probably in too much detail. But kind of like thinking through, I was thinking, well, maybe something people that don't know about me is maybe a few facts together is that I really, really, really love hip hop. And I like nothing better to listen to hip hop played really loud in my flat in Durham in particular. But also I really love knitting. So I sit in the evenings knitting and listening to hip hop.
What a great combination.
I'm knitting jumpers for my grandchildren. I've got four grandchildren now.
Oh, fantastic. Well, you leave us with a wonderful image of what's going on in the academic spires of Durham in the evening.
Yeah, exactly.
So look, it's just been an absolute pleasure to have you on the Digital Leaders podcast, Sue.
Thanks so much for inviting me, Robin. I've loved it.
That is it for this episode of the Digital Leaders podcast. Now, of course, we would love to know your thoughts. Tag us at DigiLeaders and let us know. And if you want to find out more about today's guest, head on over to our website, digileaders.com/podcast, and we have all that information there. That is it for this week. I'm your host, Robin Knowles. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of the Digital Leaders Podcast.